On behalf of the Sabre Oral History Project, I'm Steve Jaremko. This is part two of three of my interview with Jim Cott, recorded at his home in Manchester Village, Vermont, on September 10, 2019.
I had a job with a 500-watt radio station in Shakopee, Minnesota, doing high school sports. I was doing a post-game interview with Ray Scott.
He was from Pittsburgh.
Yeah. The early years, I went to the instructional league in the winter. So that occupied 2 months of my time, and they paid you a little money to do that so you could make ends meet till spring training started.
Yeah.
But then in 64, I was doing an interview with Ray, who, you know, was the voice of the Packers.
Yes.
And he said, "Well, Jimmy, what do you think you'd like to do when your career's over?" And I am, like 24 years old. I'm not thinking about when my career's over. But yeah. I said, "You know what you guys do seems like it would be fun, this, you know, announcing." So a guy in Shakopee that owned the radio station hears that. He gets a hold of the Twins. And the next thing you knew, which was a fun job. So I was doing high school basketball, high school football, signing on in the morning, doing livestock reports.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. So at this time then, there were some other players that came onto the team. It was around 1970. Louis Tiant and Bert Blyleven, Cesar Tovar.
Well, Bert, of course, I just did the games with him last week. He was like a little brother to me. He came up when he was 19 years old, and we could see right away that he was going to be something special. And, you know, we bonded because he was born in the Netherlands.
Yes,
so he's Dutchman. I'm
of
Dutch descent, so we're both Dutchmen. Louis, of course, was one of the great power pitchers when he came up, and then he had some arm injuries, but he was one of the funniest teammates I ever had. So we were teammates there for a short time, and then we were teammates again with the Yankees in 1980. Caesar is forgotten too much in Twins history. You know, he played all nine positions one game, and he was one of these guys you could slot in anywhere. Where we really bonded was in 65. That was his first year with the team. I had 4-3 lead, opening day of 65. Two out, a man on second. Joe Pepitone hits a pop-up that a little league kid could have caught. And Caesar's standing under it. I'm already halfway down to shake my hands with Earl Batty because the game's over. We win by one run. Hits the heel of his glove and he drops it. So they tie the game 4-4. Now, I'm the first hitter up in the bottom, and I say they pinch hit for me. So Caesar is on the bench there. He's really distraught and over. Pepe was his nickname. I said, "Hey, Pepe, come on." I said, you'll knock the winning run in this game. He came up to bat, man on second, knocked the winning run in.
Oh, that's a great
story.
So we
won the game. So he and I really became, he loved to play when I pitch. Yeah, and he died at a young age down in Venezuela, some kind of a stomach disorder.
Oh.
But, yeah, he was he wouldn't fit in with today's power game because, you know, he was a guy that hit singles, stole bases, bunted, could play second, third, center field, anywhere you put him. Yeah.
So your time at the Twins was coming to an end in 1973.
Right.
And you were traded to the White Sox, and you were 11-2 with the Twins when you were traded to the White Sox.
No, actually,
or you were
I was 10-11.
Oh, okay.
No, I was 11-12.
11-12. I'm sorry, I misspoke then.
Yeah, I coming off the wrist injury in 72, I had a screwball in 72 that Marv Grissom taught me, and I didn't really have my feel for pitching yet. You know, I'd missed. Say 8-9 months of pitching, but my arm was beginning to get stronger. I felt good, but I wasn't pitching well, and I knew the Twins were going to put me on the waiver list. But I remember
how did you know that? It's just
the rumors got around from the press, and I wasn't pitching much then. They were starting Tommy Hall and Dave Goltz and some other guys, so the writing was kind of on the wall. But I was throwing almost every day. Bob Rogers was our bullpen coach. So I was down there working every day, and I said, Buck was his nickname, Buck Rogers.
Buck Rogers.
I said, "You know, Buck, I know they have me on waivers, but I said, my arm is starting to feel really good. I said, I'm not done yet. And I was 34 then.
So you hadn't thought about any, had you been thinking about retiring before that?
Oh, no, I never retired. No. I still haven't. I got released in 1983, but I never retired. But anyway, so sure enough, they put me on waivers. It's kind of funny because Frank Quillacy was my manager, and he and I were teammates. So I went in to say goodbye to Frank, and Frank said, you know, I think you could still pitch, but he said, the boss, he doesn't. So now I go up to, you know, it wasn't as much of a family atmosphere then. There was a big division between the front office and so they never even came down to see me. It was just pack your bags and go. So I went up to see Calvin Griffith, and I said, hey, I just want to say goodbye. Thanks for the opportunity. He said, you know, I think you can still pitch, but Frank didn't think he could.
Oh, boy.
But anyway, so now I
talk
go
about
on
passing
to,
the buck.
Yeah, I go on to Chicago, and that's when I got back with Johnny Sain.
You had a very successful couple of years in Chicago where you were in 74, 21 and 13, and 75 you were 20 and 14. And you developed a really revolutionary quick pitch at that time. And if you could tell us a little of how that evolved.
Yeah, I had a normal pitching motion when you see a pitcher wind up. And when I came over from Minnesota, my arm felt fine. It was getting stronger, but I really wasn't getting people out. So I finished the year in 73, 4-1. I had some good games there. Comiskey Park is a big ballpark. So it was a nice pitcher's park. And then in 74, when I started out, it was it wasn't good. Harry Carey was on the radio. He was screaming for him to get rid of me. And, oh, your slow curve and your fastball are the same speed. It's time to get rid of this guy. So Chuck Tanner, after a road trip, he called me in. We're getting in to pick up our luggage, and he said, come in early tomorrow. I want to talk to you. And he and I were good friends. And I said, well, I know what it's going to be about. He's going to release me. He's just going to say, hey, you had a nice career, but you're 34 years old. You're not getting them out anymore. And so he calls me and he said, you've been averaging 15 wins a year in this league for 15 years. And I think you can still do it. So he said, I want you to go to the bullpen with Johnny. This was on a Friday. He said, you're starting on a Monday against Cleveland. 10 days. So I go down there, and my record is 4-6. And Johnny and I worked on he said, you got to get a little quicker. You got to get a quicker release. So I got quicker. It felt kind of awkward. So finally I said, okay, John, I'm standing there with the bases loaded, and there's a ground ball hit right back at me, and I'm just going to step and throw to home. And that's where it started. And I end up the year 21-13.
Yeah.
And then the next year 20-14. So it was all because of I did an interview with Jerry Remy the other night and with Boston, and he said, oh, I remember. He said, you couldn't get ready. We were asking the umpire, give me time. So it really worked well. But Johnny helped me with that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. So let me ask you, that the quick pitch, did that stay with you then for the balance of your career?
Well, it did. But when I went to Philadelphia, Chuck Tanner had told Danny Ozark, he said, first of all, they came to me in Chicago and said, you know, you've had two great years, but the team's losing money. And Mr. Allen was a good owner. We weren't drawing any people. He said, we think we have a chance to get something for you because the Mets, the Pirates, and the Phillies are looking for a veteran pitcher. So if you had your choice, where would you like to go? Well, I had seen the Phillies, and I knew they were getting better. So I said, boy, if I could go to Philadelphia, I'd love that. So that's what they arranged. They got Dick Ruthven, they got a couple top draft choices. And so now when I go to Philly, they tell Danny Ozark, the manager, said, you need to start him every 4 days, even every three. The more you pitch him, the more effective he'll be with control. And Danny, he couldn't adapt to that. Like my next start was going to be against Montreal. And he said, well, I'm going to skip you and you're going to pitch next week in Pittsburgh. He said, Montreal has all these right-hand hitters, Andre Dawson, Tim Raines, Ellis Valentine, Gary Carter, Tim Wallach. So I thought about it, and I said to Danny, you know, I think I've faced about 12,000 right-hand hitters in my career. I said, I think I had to get some of them out.
Yeah.
So, but that's the way he operated. And I never really, I found my groove, and I got my record up to 10-6. And this is a move I still rue to this day. But I had pitched the day before in 9 innings, and so I'm now sitting on the bench in the 9th inning. You know, sitting there for 9 innings, hadn't done any exercise or anything. And he points at me, said, "Go out and run for Lozinski, pinch run for Lozinski."
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had my rubber, you know, cleats on, and I thought, you don't want to have a confrontation with the manager, you know, but I really want to say, Danny, I'm not ready to do that. So I go out, and I'm hoping that it's either a home run or something. Well, the first pitch, Jay Johnstone hits in the gap. I come around, I slide into third, and I cracked my kneecap right there.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So now I end up the year 12-14, but I, with this leg all puffed up, I just wasn't the same pitcher.
Well, he didn't do your career any favors then.
No.
Yeah.
And then after that, I kind of became a relief pitcher when I went on to New York and St. Louis, which were good years, you know.
Backing up to the White Sox a little bit, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned Dick Allen.
Yeah.
Richie Allen. You're good friends with...
He was one of my favorite teammates, yeah.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about him?
He loved playing behind me. He was legendary. He was one of these guys when the wind was blowing in and they'd say, nobody's going to hit one out of here today. He went through the wind. I had a duel with Nolan Ryan. I gave up a run in like the 3rd inning. So now Nolan Ryan has a no-hitter, and he struck out 12, and we go to the... I get the last out in the top of the 9th, and we're running off the field. My nickname was Old Timer. So Dick said, "Old Timer, we're going to win this game." So he leads off against Nolan Ryan. He hits a two-hopper to the third baseman, just a routine ground ball. Whoosh, he beats it out. And then we bunted him over, and they threw the ball away. We got one hit and a sacrifice fly, and we win the game 2-1.
Wow.
Yeah. And a lot of it is just because Dick's, he had so much ability. It was tough for him because he came up in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia was not kind to their black athletes. Hmm. You know,
They had a lot of them, though.
They were as
Tony
bad
Taylor
as Boston.
And
well, but that
Tony
was...
Tony Gonzalez and...
Some of those might have got by with it because they were Hispanic.
Hmm.
But they didn't have many black stars, and Boston was the same way, you know, until Bill Russell came along. And Boston's first black player was Pumpsy Green.
Who just passed away recently.
Yeah. And so Dick really, the fans in Philadelphia used to throw, that's why he wore his helmet in the field. They used to throw batteries at him, and things. Yeah. Wow. They were really tough.
No, they were, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But he and I really, and then when I got traded to Philadelphia, he was one of the ones that pushed him to get me traded there from Chicago. So we bonded there. And then we'll still see each other once in a while at card shows.
Yeah.
He moved back to Wampum, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Wampum.
Where he's from. Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And he had brothers that were
Ronnie was a really great player. Hank, I used to see because he was still scouting. But he's not scouting anymore. But yeah, they were an athletic family.
With the Phillies, you also played with some, you mentioned Greg Luzinski, but you had Mike Schmidt, Gary Maddox, Steve Carlton.
Schmidt is probably the greatest baseball player athlete that I played with. He was, you know, he could play a lot of sports. He ended up being a great golfer. Gary was one of the best center fielders because he played very shallow. They used to nickname him the Secretary of Defense. And of course, Greg was stood right on top of the plate, great line drive hitter. Yeah. Steve Carlton was there. Talent-wise, those were the best teams I ever played on.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. We got to the playoffs. We won 100 games every year, but we got beat by the Reds and then by the Dodgers.
Then you were traded to the Yankees after your time in Philadelphia. And again, you got to play for Bob Lemon and then Billy Martin. And I assume it was primarily relief role.
Goose Gossage had been injured. So Guidry volunteered to go to the bullpen. And they just needed a left-hander. So Bertie Tebbets happened to be scouting, and I wasn't pitching much for the Phillies anymore, and he happened to be scouting. We're out in San Diego, and by desperation, they brought me into a tie game in the 10th inning. And I pitched four innings, and we end up winning the game in the 14th inning. So Bertie sends in a report, and the next thing you know, 4 days, I'm on a plane to New York. So, yeah, I pitched for three managers there in less than a year: Bob Lemon, Billy Martin, Dick Houser.
Oh, yeah. So, that, okay, yeah, Dick Houser.
Billy,
yeah,
got fired in the off season for punching a salesman in a bar somewhere, and then Dick Houser was the manager that next spring.
Yeah, so as far as your playing under Billy at that time, was there any difference in the way he had approached you as a player?
Not really. I mean, he was good for pitching me, but he was the same way. He was second guessing pitching all the time. But we had a good relationship there. Billy just self imploded all the time. In a way, we felt sorry for him because he, like, say we had a day game after a night game on Saturday, he might not get to the park till, I remember one time, Mike Ferraro had to take the lineup cards up, and he said, if you can delay the game a little bit, we got Billy in the clubhouse, we're getting him dressed and get out on the field, because George Steinbrenner is going to wonder where he is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you wind up being sold to the St. Louis Cardinals in 1980 and going 8-7, and there again you had, looks like, three managers. I know Jack Krall did one game. Looks like there, Ken Boyer, I don't know if you came before or after when he was there, but Whitey Herzog and then Red Shaneedst.
Yeah, what happened, I was on the 10-day, what they call DFA, designated for assignment, by the Yankees. So for 10 days, any team had a chance to pick me up, and then after 10 days, I would be free. And I did have a guaranteed contract. It wasn't for that much money, but I had a guaranteed contract for the rest of the year. So I was kind of surprised when I got a phone call from John Claiborne, who was the general manager of the Cardinals at that time. And he said, can you be at Busch Stadium by 12:30 tomorrow? I'm in Philadelphia. He said, we just picked up your contract.
Mm.
I said, John, I said, this is the eighth day. You could have waited 2 days. He said, no, but we need help in the bullpen right now. I said, you're not talking to Goose Gossage. You're talking to a 40-year-old relief pitcher, right? He said, no, we need a lefty. So he said, we picked up your contract. I said, okay. So I got a plane, I got a flight the next morning. I get to St. Louis. Game's already started. I get dressed. I go down the bullpen. And it's like the seventh inning, and I haven't thrown in 10 days. So I said to Dave Ricketts, the bullpen coach, I said, can you call down to Kenny Boyer and see, is it all right if I get up and throw? Just get some exercise. Yeah. So I get up and I throw. Next thing you know, Boyer calls down. He says, could he go in the game? So now Pete Vukovich is the starter. And Pete and I are teammates in Chicago. So now they call me into the game. And Vuk looks at me and like, where did you come from? So he didn't even know we were teammates. And I ended up pitching an inning and 2/3 or something and saving the game. But then Kenny got fired shortly after that, and Jack really just managed for a day or two till they hired Whitey. Yeah. Because it took Whitey a little while to, get organized and get to St. Louis. And then, Whitey really turned the organization around.
Yeah, so how would you characterize Whitey as a manager?
Well, Chuck Tanner was one of my favorites because he saved my career. He was very loyal to his veterans. But Whitey was such a sharp game manager. And what he did in those days, you tailored your team to the ballpark because Busch Stadium was a big ballpark at AstroTurf. Wasn't a home run hitter's park. So he got rid of, like, Teddy Simmons, Sixto Lascano, Kenny Reitz. He got rid of guys that were slow. So now we have Willie McGee, Ozzie Smith, Lonnie Smith. We're a speed team. And then he came to me. I had been starting. I won about 5 or 6 games as a starter there when I was 41. I really wanted to start. And he said, in fact, a cool story is in I think it was 80 or 81, John Fulgham hurt his arm. He was a right-hand pitcher with us. And Whitey said, would you like to start? I said, yeah, I'd love to start a game. I haven't started a game in a year and a half. So he said, you're going to start next Tuesday against the Mets. So he said, get ready, do your throwing program. You know, this is like on a Thursday, so I do that. So I start the game. Three innings go by, nothing. He said, how do you feel? I said, I feel fine. Well, Kenny Reitz hits a home run off Neil Allen in the 10th inning. I pitch all 10 innings, win 1-0. That wouldn't happen today. They wouldn't let you do it.
Wow.
So I was starting. And then at the end of that year, Whitey traded Kenny in some of the slower plays. Said, I'm going to build my pitching staff from the 9th inning back. I'm going to get Suter. I got Doug Bear, hard thrower. I got Jeff Lottie. I want you to be my lefty-lefty specialist. Okay, so we win the World Series the next year. And what he did, I tell people how grateful I am to be a member of the 82 Cardinal team when you look at the game today. We never made a trade outside the organization during the season, like at the trade deadline, really. We never made a trade, only called up some minor leaguers back and forth. We never had a player on the disabled list. We hit 67 home runs as a team. Now they hit 70 in a month.
Yeah.
We stole 221 bases. And we had great defense, and it was the kind of baseball fans just loved. And then we end up winning the World Series.
Yeah. It was like an old-time ball club.
Yeah.
I mean, as I recall.
Now, granted, we played on AstroTurf, so it was much easier to tailor your team.
I couldn't imagine what that difference would be like. Can you explain a little the difference between a grass field and AstroTurf as far as being playing a ball, the ground balls?
With hitters that had speed, of course, they wanted to hit the ball on the ground.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot easier to get the ball through the infield on the ground with that AstroTurf. Nowadays, it's a power game. They want to hit every ball in the air. They don't want to hit it on the ground.
Yeah.
But our theory was get 10 singles. And, Willie McGee would steal a base, two bases.
This is exciting baseball.
And, as a pitcher, the AstroTurf, it took away, but it gave you. Now, maybe a ball hit in the hole that on grass would be an out. But then a ball that was hit hard right at an infielder would end up being a double play. So, but you just adapted the play. It was a tough surface for guys playing every day on their legs. And then in St. Louis in the summer, that inversion layer, on just that when you can see it's that wavy heat.
Yes.
It'd be 120 degrees on that turf.
Oh, with the humidity and everything,
So it was a hot place to play. But
I can imagine.
Yeah, that was a wonderful team to play my last full year for.
So some of the players that I had here, Bruce Suter, you talked about a little bit, Ozzie Smith, Keith Hernandez, you had Joaquin Andujar at that time.
Yeah. Well, Keith's still a good friend. He announces games for the Mets. I was like a big brother to him. Very intense player. Great, Gold Glover, former MVP. Bruce and I are still friends to this day. I was the old timer and he was the Amishman. he had his big beard. Yeah. Yeah. And then Joaquin, the Dominican dandy, he was our best pitcher. Very volatile temper. We had to keep him under control, but he was our best pitcher. Ozzie was, of course, a wizard at short. I still see him at the Gold Glove Dinner every year. So, that infield saved us a lot of outs the way they played. Teams would look at Philly and Montreal and think, oh, they got all the power. And I remember telling Mike Schmidt, I said, we got the best team because we don't make any mistakes. We play good defense. We don't have to hit home runs to win. And so we kind of snuck up on them and surprised them.
So we're getting toward the end of your career here as far as 1983 when you were, you were released.
Yeah.
And you still haven't retired yet, so there's a chance you could be a five-decade player.
Yeah. Well, that was probably the most disappointing thing in my career, the way that was handled, and it's totally unlike the Cardinals to do that, but it was during the All-Star game, and I had pitched pretty well prior to the All-Star game, and I really thought, because we needed starters, I was going to get a chance to start some games the second half. And I get a call from Joe McDonald, who was the general manager. If I saw Joe on the street, personally, we get along well, but he was the most dishonest and unscrupulous general manager that I ever played for. So now Whitey tells me at the end of the 82 season, I said, you still want me back next year? He said, yeah, I want you lefty-lefty. So I was making $200,000 at the end of 1982. And so now I get a contract. First of all, I get a minor league contract to report to spring training. So I called Joe McDonald and I said, well, don't you and Whitey communicate? I said, I went in to see Whitey and he said he wants me back next year. So I was just waiting to see what contract. He said, well, I'm not sure. I'm looking at Andy Hassler, and he mentioned a couple other left-hand pitchers. I said, well, then you need to talk to Whitey because I'm expecting the contract. So sends me a contract for the same money. So now I did my research, and the average relief pitcher that had 5 years in the league, their average salary was $480,000. Yeah. So I wrote him. I said, Joe, I don't expect $480,000, but I would expect some kind of a raise. Well, he tells Whitey that I'm asking for $480,000. And so now Whitey writes me a letter and said, hey, I told you I want you back, and but not at this price. He said, I can't do that. And then he said, I heard you didn't show up for the writer's dinner in St. Louis because you were unhappy with your contract. So, you know, you didn't have email and stuff, those. And so then I had to get back to him and say, no. The reason I didn't go to the writer's dinner is my dad was on his deathbed and subsequently died. So I was home in Michigan with my dad. So that created a real chasm with Whitey, because Joe was his man. And Joe was kind of lying to me. So I knew at the start of 83, I wasn't, and I understood that. They had a couple young guys, Davon Olin. So I wasn't being used as much, but I still could have been an effective pitcher. So now he calls me on that All-Star break and said, yeah, we're going to release you because we can pick up Dave Rucker, a left-hand pitcher that they've been looking at. And so, you know, we're going to release you. Today they would be feeding you at home plate to because you retired, because at the time that was the longest career in baseball.
Yeah.
But that's kind of that was a classless way.
It was.
For the Cardinals to, and it's not like the Cardinals. And I see Whitey now, we get along. So I go back to St. Louis, pack up my gear, and I'm leaving. There's a few writers there. Well, what do you think? And I didn't want to make a mistake and start, you know, whining about the way. I said, you know what? I've had the greatest 25-year vacation, paid vacation, longer than anybody's ever played. So I said, I was happy to be here and be part of a World Series. And I did make a couple of calls. I could have joined the Giants, but I wanted a guarantee to go to spring training the next year with a contract, because otherwise I want to find something else to do.
Yeah.
And nobody could guarantee me that. So I started doing some baseball games for ESPN.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Pete Rose called and asked me to be his pitching coach. So
I remember you being with the Pirates on spring training.
I went to Chuck Tanner. I was at the end of 83. I was doing radio shows at the winter meetings, radio interviews, in Nashville. And Chuck sees me. And he said, well, you look like you still pitch. I said, Chuck, I know I can still pitch. But I said, youth and economics, you know.
Yeah.
I said, I'd pitch for the minimum, but they don't want to take a 44-year-old guy here, and they got three of these 20-year-old kids that want a chance, and if they see a 44, they're going to say, well, when am I going to get called up?
Sure.
So he said, why don't you come to camp with us? So I went to camp with the Pirates in 84. Had a good spring. I pitched against, like, Rice and Lynn and some of the Red Sox hitters, and I did well. But the Pirates had Rod Scurry and Chris Green, and I think they had a bunch of left-hand pitchers. So Chuck told me last week of March, he said, and Pete Peterson, he said, you're not going to be on our roster, but call some teams and see if they can pick you up.
Because I thought they offered to Hawaii. Is that
No, they never did that. Okay. So I called Lou Gorman, who was the general manager of the Red Sox, and they needed a lefty. So I said, Lou, I think I could help your team. I said, you need a left-hand pitcher, left-hand relief pitcher. And I had a couple good innings against him. He He said, "Well, Jim, we got this kid, John Henry Johnson." And he said, "How old are you now?" I said, "I'm 44. I said, "I can't lie about my age, but I said, if you're worried about me getting hurt, I'll make you a deal. I said, you give me a contract for the minimum, and I'll put it in the special covenants that if I'm disabled, you don't have to pay me. Because the only way I'll be disabled is if I break my arm, and if I break my arm, my career's over anyway." Well, we're gonna go with John Henry Johnson. And I said, you know, he gets hurt all the time. So a month into the season, I'm sitting at home, I'm reading USA Today, disable this John Henry Johnson.
Oh, wow.
So every time I would see Lou Gorman after that, I said, you could have had me for practically nothing.
Well, you look like you could go out there and pitch tomorrow.
But that's kind of how, I enjoyed my time there with the Pirates because I got to know Willie real well, Stargell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that was a good way. But then I was still doing, in the early part of that year, I did some TV games. And then when Pete got the managing job in Cincinnati, he had always told me, when Pete made an out, he liked to run across the mound, Pete Rose. And I would he wasn't as good a hitter right-handed, so I got a lot of ground ball outs. And he'd make that circle, and he'd run around by the mound, and I would see him out of the corner of my eye, and I'd move over so he had to run around. And he'd look back at me, no one grinned. So he told their batting practice pitcher one day, he said, "If I ever get a managing job, you tell Jim I want him to be my pitching coach." So that's how all that started. So when he got the managing job, he called me, and I was his pitching coach for a year and a half there.
Yeah, and did you implement some of the same things that Johnny Sain?
Exactly. Went to a four-man rotation. We had our pitchers throw a lot. Tommy Browning won 20 games, first rookie to do that in 30-some years. Yeah, and we had our relievers. It was fun. I enjoyed it, in fact.
Sounds like you had a really good program for
it. Yeah, Marge Schott owned the team then, and she was a tough cookie.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't want to pay scouts. She said, "What are we paying scouts for? All they do is watch games." Well, yeah, that's what scouts do, you know. And I said to Pete, if I could just get a multi-year deal here for some decent money, I would love to stay. I couldn't do that. And then Tim McCarver had his broadcast agent call me and say, we think you have a future in broadcasting because before all the alternate programming and TV, if there was a rain delay, they'd call a player up from the clubhouse. So I used to sit and tell stories with Richie Ashburn and Harry Callis.
Yeah.
And then the producers there would hear that and say, "Oh, you ought to go into this business." So that's kind of how.
So you got to know Richie Ashburn too, then.
Oh, yeah. Great friends. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Harry Callis.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So I wanted to try to start to transition into the broadcast areas a little bit, but I did have some other general questions about the baseball. And I think we've covered a lot of this fitness. Like, how did you keep in such good shape throughout the year?
Well, I think in the early years, even though I had a job in the off season, I played a lot of basketball. I played a lot of handball, which turned into racquetball.
Right.
So yes. I was always pretty active, even though I had a job. Some guys would come to spring training, overweight in spring training was a way you got in shape. And the older I got, I said, I have to go to spring training in shape because if I have any little injury, it's going to take a little longer mm-hmm. to get ready. So every spring as I got into my 30s, I would go to spring training earlier. I had a kid down there that I played catch with, and so I would kind of start my throwing program a lot earlier so I'd be ready to beat off the younger competition.
Yeah, oh, wow. Yeah. You had a really good organized plan about how to approach every year.
Yeah.
That's excellent. What assortment of pitches did you have? I guess the question is, how would you compare your Jim Cotton in 1959 versus Jim Cotton in 1983 with the assortment of pitches you had and what you learned? And I know you became a very savvy pitcher and very...
Yeah, I think it was mostly control. Control of my fastball, even though I didn't throw exceptionally hard. Back in 1962, I was pitching against Whitey Ford. We were the starting pitchers. And we were in Minnesota. And our bullpens, if I'm warming up here, Whitey's about through that doorway, their Yankee bullpen. It's a day game, and I can hear his fastball spinning. I can hear it going, you know, sinking. So I'm 22 years old. Whitey's like, yeah, because we correspond. I have a nice picture on my wall of he and I at home 50 years after I won my first game against him. Yeah. He's bad dementia now down in Fort Lauderdale.
Right?
But he's 90. He'll be, when I turn 81, he turns 91 almost, you know, to the year.
Wow.
But anyway, I thought, I wonder if I walk over and ask Whitey how he holds his fastball. He might tell me, take a hike. Hey, kid, I'm pitching against you. So it was a hot day. He wipes off his brow. I run over to the fence. I said, Whitey, do you mind showing me how you hold your fastball? So, you know, they call this now the four seam, and they call that the two seam. So he had a way of gripping it right diagonally, and then he said, I curl my fingers there. I lay my thumb on it real light so I have a good loose wrist. Thank you. I go back, and I said to Paul Ratliff, I gripped it like that. Well, I gripped my fastball like that for 21 years. The next 21 years.
Wow.
Just asking him about it.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And then, you know, I changed my delivery. You know, you'd change, like Eddie Lopat told me after my first good year, he said, you know, you had a good year this year. So, yeah, he said, you have to be twice as good next year to be as good as you were this year. I'm scratching my head. I'm thinking, what do you mean by that? How can that happen? But what he was saying is, you have to keep getting better, because now Mickey Mantle's seen you. So you either got to improve your control, you got to improve your pitch, you got to change a different pattern with which you're pitching. So I always felt like every year I needed to try to improve and get better.
Well, you sure demonstrated that.
And then the last few years, of course, I pitched in relief, so I was kind of a sidearm lefty guy then. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit and get your opinion of an all-time team. A lot of times they'll ask, like, who would be your all-time team? I'm going to ask you to pick two all-time teams. So if you would be willing to, like two catchers. You know, for instance, who would be the players you played with? Not the old-timers or, you know, the current crop of players that you see now. But of the players that you played with, who would be the top two catchers, for instance?
That were on my team?
No, that you played against or with. During your playing years.
Yeah. So, of course, Earl in the area was a Gold Glove catcher. Bill Freehand was an All-Star catcher for the Tigers. I think probably those two in the early 60s would have been the top ones.
First base.
Well, of course, you want me to span my whole playing career?
Your whole? Yeah. Yes, if you
well,
would.
Well, then I put Keith. I put Keith at first base. Yeah, Keith Hernandez. I think I'd probably put Don Mincher.
Mm-hmm. We hadn't talked about him, but yeah.
Yeah. Combination hitting and fielding.
Mm-hmm. Second.
Second would be, I mentioned these on my own team. You want the whole league.
Whoever you played with you know, during your playing career, I guess, if you could do it that way.
Like during my playing career at second, the best, you know, defensive second baseman was Bobby Richardson.
Mm.
Yeah. And then, you know, later who came up with me would be Rod.
Oh, Rod, sure.
Yeah. And then at short we had, actually, it's tough to separate them. Zoilo had the MVP year, but then you had Ozzie and Larry Boa.
Oh, Larry
Boa.
Who
was a great defender. You know, Zoilo, Larry and Ozzie were both great fielders, and then Zoilo was, you know, a better offensive threat than those two. Yeah.
Yes. Third base.
Well, Mike Schmidt and Brooks Robinson.
Oh, of course, yeah. So left field?
Yaz.
Yaz.
Yes.
Would Harman be there?
No, Harman would have to be a DH.
A DH, I have that.
Yeah.
I have DH.
Yeah,
it's tough to
put him at a position. I could put him at first base.
Oh, yeah, I know you could, yeah. Yes. We have DH.
But I could put Harman in left. Let's see who else. I think he's... You know, it's hard to scan in right now.
Sure.
When I think about the whole career. I might put Joe Rudy in there.
Oh, Joe Rudy, wow.
You know, it's hard to separate him at third because I've omitted George Brett. You know, it's just to narrow it down to two. It's
well,
tough.
Did Roger Maris play left field? Or?
Roger Maris played right.
Oh, he played right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then in center again, you had, well, I'd say, you know, you had Mickey and then... I played with Willie McGee and then Gary Maddox.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
So it's tough to separate them there. Right field, you had Kaline and Frank Robinson.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, I'm partial to George Hendricks, who was our right fielder with the Cardinals, but, you know, the other two guys are Hall of Famers.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he wasn't too popular in Pittsburgh.
No, but he was really a solid teammate.
Oh, he was.
Good right fielder for us.
So, designated hitter, we have Harman.
Well, if we'd use Harman, and then let's make Dick Allen.
Okay, yeah. That's a good pick. So now, right-handed pitcher, and then we'll do left-handed pitchers. So you need four pitchers.
During my playing time.
Yes, if you'd like to do it that way. Yes.
Yeah, so I would say lefty, Steve Carlton.
Uh-huh.
And... I would say Carlton and Koufax, if I can have two lefties.
Sure, there's two lefties and two righties.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I would go Gibson and Marischal.
Wow, that didn't take long.
Yeah.
So where's Cott?
No. Well, you know, the cool thing is when Dick Allen named his all-time team, he named Gibson and myself because he liked guys that work fast and throw strikes.
Oh, sure.
Good defense. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the assessment of today's game. So, first of all, I guess overall, maybe this is too broad. I was going to ask your impressions of today's game, but maybe I'll say, what's your pitching opinion of pitching counts?
Well, I think they've really dumbed down pitching because... The good pitchers, I saw Eduardo Rodriguez last night, 6 innings, 1 run. They took him out of the game. There is no data that says that limiting pitches will eliminate an injury. But you can't expect them now to just take these guys and say they're going to pitch 9 innings. It has to start in the minor leagues, the way we were trained. And because they're doing that and hot-housing pitchers, we're just not developing any complete game pitchers anymore, and that's too bad because I'd love to see Max Scherzer and Jacob DeGrom going head-to-head in the ninth inning, you know, and that doesn't happen. So I'm not happy at all, and I guess I'm not happy with the people in the game that were former pitchers that know better, but they're all beholden to these analytics people that think they have all this information, and it's just chaos. I mean, it's just hogwash, put it in a kind term.
You know, the follow-up is, are complete games a thing of the past?
Well, they are, not because pitchers aren't capable, but because baseball doesn't realize the importance of them. If you look at our record when we pitch complete games, like I pitch 180 complete games. I think my record is 139-31, would that be? Or 149-31?
Of your complete games, I'll have to check it. But that
and the ERA
good.
Is like in the high ones.
Wow.
So now, I had a lot of bad games. But if you look at the record in complete games, it shows you that if a guy's got it going, you let him go. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, like last night, they could have let Eduardo Rodriguez go, and he may have pitched 9 innings, and maybe they would have won the game. But the pitchers are capable of it, but I don't think baseball people understand the importance of it. You know, now they're trying to figure out a way to cobble together a game with four or five relievers because nobody, if they just had a guy that pitched one complete game every round, they'd give the bullpen a rest. You know, like when Steve Carlton pitched for us in Philadelphia, we always called that win day. We said, you know, you don't even have to wear your spikes out for the bullpen. The lefty's going to win. He's going to pitch a complete game, and the bullpen's going to get a rest. And, you know, Seaver was that way, Gibson, Marischal, Koufax. And I'd say Jack Morris is one of the last. Burt had a lot of complete games, Burt Blylevin. But, yeah, it's not that the pitchers are soft or not capable. It's just, you know, I like the people. I like the players in today's game. I think they have more ability than we had by far. But the game has become boring, and baseball doesn't want to admit that, and they can't figure out a way to remedy it. And the number one way to remedy it is you better deaden the ball. If you don't want the ball flying out of the park every other at-bat, you better deaden the ball and regulate the bat. But they won't do that because I think, just like the young kid that caddied for me on the golf course yesterday, he's 22, just graduated from college. I said, would you enjoy a game like I did last week in Boston when 2-1 game, a lot of good pitching defense, and then Eddie Rosario throws out the tying run at the plate for the last out of the game? But I said, that'd be boring to you. You want to see 8 or 10 home runs. He said, yeah, see, that's the only game they grew up with. So they don't understand the way we feel.
We went to a Binghamton Rumble Ponies game. That's our minor league club there. And, you know, it was an exciting, it was 2-1 game. And, man, we were riveted. It's a great game. So, in fact, this is one of the questions I have. Is, with so much emphasis on home runs, do you see any prospect of returning to dead ball area tactics of bunting, slapping hits to move the players, you know, those we just talked about? So,
yeah, I don't see it happening because they want to expand, and that's going to mean that pitching is going to be diluted even more. Not that pitchers aren't potential big leaguers.
I haven't heard that. Where do they want to? How many more teams do they want to add?
Well, I think they'd like to add 2. Yeah, but you know, when you have inexperienced pitchers that aren't really ready to pitch in the big leagues yet, that's why you have a lot of walks and you have a lot of home runs.
I'll see. Well, there is room for you, Jim. Come back. Yeah. So, is there any way to shorten the game, quicken the pace?
Well, Kenny Rosenthal did an article. I don't know if you know that name. He's a writer, writes for The Athletic now, a longtime sports writer. He does some sideline work for Fox. And so I said, well, look, I'll give you my thoughts. It's strictly fantasy. It'll never happen. But I said, when I came up, there were 16 teams. Baseball had, from mid-April till October, that was it. There was no football, no hockey, no basketball, no tennis. Golf wasn't a big deal. So they owned the summer. So we had 154 games, then went to 162. Now football just started, first week of September. Hockey and basketball just ended the last week of June.
Yeah.
So baseball doesn't have that audience. So I said they ought to shorten the season to about 125 games. They ought to end it on Labor Day, start the playoffs, or maybe go 4 days a week because a lot of these players that are bigger and stronger, they're suffering too many injuries. Maybe that would cut down on the injuries. 7-inning games. Mm-hmm. That means the pitcher who went 6 innings would almost get a complete game. Yeah. Maximum of 10 pitchers on a staff. So you wouldn't have these. You know, the Red Sox had 17 pitchers in their bullpen the other night. Yeah. And they used 10 of them. And it was the first time in 25 years, the guy that owns a parking lot outside of Boston, Fenway Park, the first night that his lot was not filled. You know, the fans are losing interest. So those are kind of my thoughts on.
Oh, wow, that's...
It'll never happen. But
so it's hopeless, in other words.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was aware of when we watch major league games, as opposed to our minor league clubs, as the batter gets up there and he's adjusting his gloves, and they fool around, and they have theme music for them now. They have to wait and get through their theme music.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, wow, that's really...
I said years ago to the commissioner, I said, can you find a company that can make a batting glove that doesn't have to be adjusted? Because I timed it one game with hitter stepping out of the box and doing this. It adds 20, 25 minutes to the game.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, Aaron Judge is one of the few hitters right now. I saw him last. He doesn't step out of the box very often between pitches. But you know, they usually all step out and they go through, they go all through all there, and then they fasten this. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your opinion of the salaries the players are getting?
Well, that's TV. I understand that. Yeah. You know, that's TV, and, you know, the fact that baseball is international now and you have people watching it on their devices where they're buying a subscription to, you know, watch it. Even I might watch a game. I think tonight Boston's playing Toronto. I might have that game on, but then I'll probably have the Minnesota-Washington game on my iPad because I have they pay for it for me.
So you can multitask.
So I have the MLB subscription, but fans would buy that for $120 a year. But if you multiply that times the millions of fans that would do it, and then the TV rights, that's where they're generating all this income, and then the value of the franchises goes up. So, it is kind of sad that Marvin Miller told us when he was head of our Players Association years ago that if you players stick together, you'll beat them at every turn because they can't trust one another. You know, if one team offers Bryce Harper then we're going to offer him $350, you know.
Yeah, right.
So they get in a bidding war amongst themselves where if they were all fiscally responsible, they could keep those salaries more in check.
Were you a player rep or were you ever involved with that?
In the early days, with Marvin. Yeah.
With Marvin? Yeah. So that must have been quite an experience. Right? Yeah, I didn't have any questions on that, but yeah. I imagine that I...
Well, basically what he did is he taught us how to stick together. He said, you know, I know it'll be intimidating. We had that first strike in 72 for 9 days. We wanted more meal money. We wanted the minimum salary to go from 6 to 10. And... Pete was not happy about it. Pete Rose, he said, 9 days salary cost me $6,000. So fast forward to 1980 and 79 or 80s. It might have been 79. He's in spring training with the Phillies. And Marvin is there addressing us as he did every spring. And he says to Pete, I know you're unhappy with the strike in 72. Cost you $6,000 for 9 days. But I hope you think it was worth it. He just signed a 4-year deal for $3.2 million, which in those days was like the highest contract.
Yeah.
So he said, I remember when he said somebody thought that we were maybe pushing the envelope a little too far. And so he said, well, how many lawyers do you think are in this square block in New York City? 1,000? How many players? There's only 600 of you guys. I'm going to teach you how much you're worth.
Yeah. Well, Marvin Miller, he was involved with the steel business as a negotiator.
Yeah, the owners recommended him to us, like Mr. Galbraith and Mr. Fetzer, I believe, of the Tigers. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So at the time, when players were starting to become more represented and like, you had low per diems on meals and...
When I broke in, $8 a day was meal money.
Wow.
Minimum salary was $6 for 30 years. And then we wanted meal money to go to $12. We wanted the minimum salary to go to $10. And then we wanted, I think we got $150 a week. Allowance and spring training, little things like that. But the big issue, of course, was keeping our percentage of the TV rights for the pension plan.
Oh, yeah. Sure. So the pension plan was the aim.
Yeah, see, the originally there was $1 million a year from the All-Star game that the late Commissioner Happy Chandler
helped negotiate. So that was going into our pension plan.
So if they had two All-Star games, that yeah. was, that's the reason.
Well, that we'll say a million was that, but we got, I want to say, 60% of it. So the owners agreed to that. Now, all of a sudden, that TV right money is growing. Now it's up to $10 million. Well, they don't want to give us our 60% anymore. So that's what we battle for, to keep that, which is why right now I have a, you know, I have a really good baseball pension. The players today making the millions, it's not important to them.
Now, was that pension, was that retroactive to some of the older players, like the ones we were talking about?
Yeah, we went back and picked up... If they didn't pick them up for the pension, they had a fund to they got a raise, and then if there were some that were destitute, we have an association called BAT, Baseball Assistant Team, and they will find out very discreetly, so-and-so's fallen on hard times, he can't pay his rent, stuff like that. So they
hearing an interview with Jim Pagliaroni, and I think he was involved with that. He was a catcher.
I remember him, yeah.
Yeah, I think he was involved with that.
Yeah.
Wow, isn't that something? So, are you? Of course, you have an excellent sense of today's games. Who would you rank as some of the players that you're watching today, some of the best players in the game?
Well, Mike Trout, of course, is the obvious one. Nolan Arenado from Colorado is one of the tops. Mookie Betts. So many talented players today. There's some under the radar guys that aren't making the money that Harper or Machado are, like DJ LeMahieu of the Yankees. Has been a great acquisition. So, like I said, the physical ability of the players out there today is fantastic. It's just from a pitcher's standpoint. I just wish they could throw the ball out and let them play, and not control them with all this data that they have, because it's not really good for the game, in my opinion.
My grandson lives in Houston, so of course he's an Astros fan, and he was texting me so excited about the Verlander game.
Yeah,
that was pretty exciting.
Right.
He said he was one walk away
from a perfect game. Yeah. See, he's a guy now in postseason. He and this Garrett Cole. They can go nine innings if they want them to.
Yeah,
easily. I wanted to ask a few questions about your broadcasting career.
Sure.
We talked about how it began. Were you always good or comfortable with public speaking?
Yeah, I took speech in high school, and then, like I said, I had that radio job. So it's always come easy for me. And then I had some good, you know, mentors along the line, Bill White and Dick Enberg and Dick Stockton, and guys that were producers like Harry Coyle. So I really, you know, learned that game like I learned baseball. I mean, I went at it like it was baseball. I tried to learn from the guys that were the best, and I was fortunate that it came rather easy for me.
Tim McCarver was one of the...
Yeah, Timmy. Timmy, because we were teammates, and... I learned a lot from Timmy. We used to really watch the whole game, even when we weren't playing, you know, so we pick up...
I love listening to the games that you've broadcast. You have so much information, and one of the questions I had is, how can you retain so much of the facts and knowledge? Because in this interview, you haven't missed anything, as far as I can tell.
I don't know. That's just a gift, you know. I don't know. It's from... being a fan so much from when I was a kid. But I really isolate myself. I like to watch golf. I go to the horse races once in a while, Saratoga. I love to go to the Traverse, which I did well at this year. But I isolate my... I'm not a big pro football fan. I mean, I might watch the Patriots. I like Tom Brady, but... Uh-huh. I'm a baseball guy, and that's really what I focus my attention on. I always have, and I think that's why, you know, that stuff has come easy for me.
How would you describe your on-air style and persona?
Well, when I first started out, some of the agents and networks, you need a little more sizzle. You know, they wanted everybody to get excited, and and Joe Garagiola had told me years ago, you're going to get into this business. You know, don't try to sound like a
Dan, rather like a news anchor, just be yourself. And so I did that, and I learned from John Madden, you know, not to take a lot of notes, but just to watch the game, do your homework, so you're not looking down here because you got a lot of notes. You can say, oh, I got to get this in, and then you force it in, doesn't sound right. So I just watched the game, and I imagine that I'm watching a game. I'm sitting in a box with three other people. So I have one that he might be there for the first time. And then you have a pretty interested fan, and then you have an avid fan. And if you can give all of them something and then not talk down to the people, but talk like you're right there with them, you know, that's just what I try to do. The other night, for example, Bert Blylevin mentioned something about... I think it was the arm side and the controller, and I was trying to explain. Then I said, for those of you that don't know what he's talking about, it's, you know, I'm a lefty, and this is my arm side, and I want to get the ball. There was some other point he made, too, that I thought, well, somebody that doesn't know baseball a lot might not know what that means. Sure. So, you know, I try to do all of those, and I just watch the game and talk about what I see.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Did any of your comments ever cause trouble that you've made over the years or get you in?
I had a couple instances in my early Yankee days. One of them's kind of humorous, but the first Yankee game I did, opening day, in 86 with Bill White and Scooter. So Dave Winfield comes up in the ninth inning against Dan Quisenberry, and the Yankees are leading there like by 4 runs, and Winfield bumps. And I said, I'm shocked that a power hitter like Dave Winfield would bunt with a 4-run lead. Now, I didn't blast him and say, that's a stupid play. But Dick Young, who was a very controversial writer, he wrote it up like, oh, here's the rookie broadcaster. He's not afraid to rip the star player on opening day. So I know Dave from his Minnesota days. So yeah. I always made it a point. If there was something I said that might rub somebody the wrong way, I want to be in the clubhouse the next day.
Oh, yeah.
So I was in the clubhouse. I went over and I saw Dave, and we kind of laughed about it because he said, I know what you said. So he didn't. And then one day the Tigers made the Yankees made a trade for Charlie Hayes in 96 when they won the series. So we had what's called the Budweiser quote book, and Jim Leyritz was quoted as saying, I don't know why they got Charlie Hayes, because Wade Boggs and I can handle third base just fine. So I say on the telecast, here's our Budweiser quote, and I said, if Jim Leyritz thinks he can play third base like Charlie Hayes, he's never seen Charlie Hayes play. Well, these days, a lot of their parents watch the game. So now we're in Oakland, I think it was the next day, and Leyritz... We're friends now. We sat next to each other at the Masters a couple years ago. The next day he said, I want to talk to you. You ripped me on TV last night. You ripped me. So I've heard this before. I said, really? What did I say? He said, you said I couldn't play third base. I said, really? Yeah, my dad told me. He's watching the game. I said, you want to get the tape and find out exactly what I said? So we go, and I said, I'll tell you what I said. And then I told him.
Yeah.
Now I said, do you think you can play third base as well as Charlie Hayes? Well, he couldn't answer that.
Yeah, so that's
that was it. Yeah.
Wow.
So I had an incident like that. And then the one, I was doing the Yankee games, and Rob Carew's the hitting coach for the Angels. And so Andy Pettit's pitching, and he's cruising along. And now we have a shot of Rod in the dugout talking to, I think, Wally Joyner, and he has a baseball in his hand. And he's pointing to Andy Pettit. Well, now the Yankee, I tell this on TV, I said, Rod Carew, I think, has Andy Pettit's pitches, and he's telling his teammates. And now Andy starts getting hit. Well, Chili Davis, who's also a good friend, he's up and hearing it on TV, and he thinks that I'm the one. So he comes down on the bench, and he says, oh, Kitty's got Andy Pettit's pitches, and he's telling them over TV and the Angels.
Oh,
so now that the next day I get a call from our producer, and he said,
Joe Torre wants you to come in early today. He said they're a little upset about what you said on TV. What did I say? So he told me. So I go in and see Joe, and Joe said, I heard the tape. I said, but that's how all that stuff gets started. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So no, I haven't had any. Because I've always, like with Alex Rodriguez, he wasn't happy that I did a split screen of he and Derek Jeter with their swings, and Alex's swing was real long, and he wasn't hitting well with men on base late in the game. So I mentioned that.
I just called it out, yeah.
Yeah, and so the next day, hi, Alex. Didn't talk to me.
Whoa.
So then all year long, now the next spring, my first day in camp, he says to the PR guy, I want to talk to Jim. Okay, so we go in the back room. He said, you know, I had a lot on my plate last year, and I was offended by what you said. I'd just like to start over. And I said, hey, Alex, that's fine. I said, let me tell you something. I'm not your PR man. You know, I work for the viewer. So my job is to tell him what I say. I said, if you hit 50 home runs and 200 RBIs, you make my job easy. But when they're throwing the fastball by you up there, I got to tell people why.
Yeah.
So he understood that, and we get along fine.
So something like that comparison you had of the Derek Jeter and Rodriguez in their similar swings, that's something you would call for your producers to?
Yeah.
You would ask, you'd say, look, I've noticed this.
Hey, tomorrow I want to see
this.
Because Alex was hitting about a buck something, and Jeter, you know, that inside-out swing. So I'd say tomorrow. And, of course, the MLB network can do all kinds of that stuff with the technology now. But MSG was good, too. So I said, I'd like to have a split screen of those two. And then you'll do it sometime with a pitcher. Like, if he's changed his position on the rubber or his motion, we'll have a half a screen showing what it was early in the year or last year. And then what it is right now.
See, that's very astute. So you that's what, you know, that's one of the things you look for all the time is to see how they're, what's changed.
When I watch a game down here, I often watch it with it muted.
Oh.
Because I like to just watch the game and see. And if I listen, maybe I get distracted, but I can see. Like, I watch, and I love Xander Bogaerts. And a lot of the guys are the same way. They get a hit today, and they jog to first base.
Yeah.
And they never make that turn. So then I'll say to our producers, get a shot of Pete Rose from 30 years ago when he
went running
around first base. And
he'd run on walks.
Yeah, and I said, that's the way guys got to be running the bases.
Yeah, he was a hustler. They called him right. Charlie Hustle.
Yeah.
Yeah, great guy. So we're almost done. We got just a couple more of these philosophical questions.
Okay.
What do you believe is your most important contribution to the game of baseball?
Well, I've always respected the game. I had a manager in the minor leagues, Del Wilbur, say, you know, the game got along pretty well before you got here. It'll get along fine after you leave. So always respect the game. And I feel like I've been, I guess you'd say, an ambassador for the game as well as a player and a coach. And I probably one of the neatest comments that I had was when I went to Bruce Sutter's Hall of Fame induction, and Bruce and I were teammates, and he had me stand up and he said, I never played with anybody who took so much pride in putting the uniform on every day, because I would come into the clubhouse like when I was 43 and the lockers, you know, we have our uniforms in the locker with our name on the back, and I'd say to the clubhouse guys, made it another day. I got a uniform in my locker. Yeah.
Would you do anything differently if you had to do it all over again?
Yeah, I wish I had I'd have developed a good changeup.
What's your advice to aspiring ball players?
I think the same thing. I think, you know, now there's a lot of personal showmanship and style, and I just think I'd like to see guys respect the game, learn about the history of the game, learn about how important the game of baseball has been, you know, kind of to the culture of America, how much it used to be called America's game. And if you're making a lot of money in today's game, you ought to look back at some of the guys that are responsible for
helping you get to where you're at. This just didn't fall out of the sky. So yeah, I think that'd be the stuff I'd want to talk
about. Sounds good. What's your advice to aspiring broadcasters?
Well, I think you need to attack the profession of broadcasting the same way you did playing. Bill White had told me to listen to tape recorder, you know, of games that I did in spring training, learn to do play-by-play, and then find out guys that did it well. Like if you're a radio broadcaster today, you get a guy like Gary Thorne, who's been a play-by-play guy for the Orioles for years, and ask guys like I did. I got a pitching lesson from Warren Spahn in my early 60s, and then I talked to Whitey, and I'd go to guys like that, Robin Roberts. So talk to the guys like Bob Costas, my partner who went to Syracuse, is a great all-around broadcaster. If a young kid or parents say, oh, my son wants to get into broadcasting, talk to a guy like Bob Costas. Often today, the MLB Network and all these, they just take like a former player and they throw him on the air. And they just think, well, he doesn't have any of the fundamentals of broadcasting. Like Harry Coyle, who was a great director, he said, you've got 8 seconds between pitches to get your thought out. You don't want to start a story when there's two out and then all of a sudden you're lingering on. And you gotta, so, you know, little fundamental things like that that I learned from Dick Enberg and Dick Stockton and John Madden and Harry Coyle and directors like that.
Sure. Who would you say was the most influential person in your baseball career?
Well, number one would be my dad, Jack McKeon, when he caught me in Missoula, and Johnny Sain as a pitching coach. Yeah.
So maybe this question is also similar. Who was the most influential person in your entire life?
It would be my dad and my brother-in-law. Oh. My brother-in-law, who passed away at 94, Max Dupree, in the Business Hall of Fame, but he was like a second father to me. And just a lot of life lessons about how to conduct myself. But I would say in general, it would be my parents. You know, I grew up in a very stable home. When you see kids today, you look back and say, man, was I lucky? I thought this was normal for everybody.
Yeah.
And so, I would say the family life, the community that I had, that I grew up in, that was so influential on me that helped me to... I think handle myself through baseball.
It seemed like a good, really good place to grow up.
Yeah, I always had the attitude that, well, if I don't make it playing baseball, even though that's all I ever wanted to do, I think I'd like to go be a high school basketball coach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so and then I had some kids that I played with in the minor leagues. I'd see him the next day in front of their locker and they're in tears. I said, what's the matter, Larry Barbie? I said, what's the matter, Larry? He said, you didn't have cell phones. And he said, well, I called my dad last night and I told him, you know, I had a bad game. And his dad is berating him. What do you mean? Yeah. You gave up 5 runs or something? You know?
Yeah.
Well, I never had that kind of... In fact, one cute little story, because I was a good high school basketball player, but I wasn't a scorer. You know, I passed and I played defense. In one game, I scored a few more points than I normally do. So I come out 3 blocks from school where we played, so I walk in the back door. I'm feeling pretty good. First thing my dad said is, Carl really threw you some nice passes, didn't he? So he put everything in perspective.
Oh, that's wonderful. So your family now, would you like to tell us a little bit about what your hobbies, interests, and what's
well,
your
my sister's still living. She's 93. I go to visit there every year, get a lot of nieces and nephews there. Because I was widowed 11 years ago. I met Margie was a golf pro, and she was widowed when she was 37.
I thought she was a trout fisher.
Well, she is now. She is now, yeah. But she was a golf pro. And a couple hooked us up because, you know, she was widowed. She was only married for 9 months, never had any kids. And now I'm widowed. My kids are all grown, and I love golf. So they put us together, and we've been together now for 10 years. And now instead of golf, she fishes.
Well,
but I have 7 grandkids.
Seven grandkids?
Yeah.
Grandkids. So how many children?
two biological, and then two with Marianne, who was my second wife.
Oh, I see.
And stepson and daughter, who are doing very well. So yeah, and all my grandkids are fine and healthy. And which the older you get, as my mother used to say, like, oh, if you just have your health. I'm 10 years old, I'm thinking, what's the big deal? Isn't everybody healthy? And then when you get to be 80, you understand.
Yeah.
Well, for those people who can't see this interview, Mr. Kott looks to be in excellent shape. So what do you enjoy doing the most in life?
I'll go right down here and play golf.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's really what I do for a hobby. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my passion, like Margie's fishing.
Oh, wow. Well, good. And you were at a bridge game earlier.
Yeah, I played bridge. And then, of course, I'm still doing like 20 games on TV.
Yeah.
So, you know, staying involved like that keeps me involved with baseball so that
sure does.
I can't play golf every day. So it's really a good combination. You know, I get to, you know, like last week, Sam Kennedy, who's the president of the Red Sox, and then the guys on the Twins that I know are Cleveland, Tito Francona will be there. So I'm running into all these people that I either played against that are coaches now, and that's really the enjoyable part of the game. Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you that as an interviewer, this has been a wonderful experience, and I just want to thank you on behalf of Sabre for everything that you've done for the game of baseball. And you are the most excellent ambassador I could think of. And we were so lucky to have you play the game as well and for as long as you did, Mr. Kott.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How generous you are with your time. Thank
wow.
you.
I'm glad this worked out. Yeah, I made sure I had... I'm doing
can I take a photo of you right there?
Yeah.
I want to get that picture.
I do have...